Hey, this goes out to the ABS fam, to the crew getting ready at the Pepsi can. DJ Triple T banging thunder with the hype jams. My dog Bernie getting smiles in the West Stands. To the kids in the hall playing hockey. Radio Moser with the call, I know you got me. To the man who caught the puck with his bare hand. Jake Schroeder paying respects with the national anthem. To all the jerseys and the signs and the programs. LG Red, Nikki Hurdle in the beer man. TV crews, beat reporters and the ice girls. To Rycroft, Kiefer and John Lyles. To Big Z, Mac, Landy and Rantanen. To the crowd getting fizzy at the Pepsi can. To the one and only world's best hockey fans. Here we go, shout out ABS fam.
The ColoradoHockey.com podcast is brought to you by ABSFAM.com.
All right, stop me if you've heard this one before. Two beat reporters walk into a bar.
What sounds like a bad joke is actually a serendipitous moment that I hadn't quite prepared for when I arranged to meet Adrian Dater at Bender's Bar and Grill, sitting high above the green rink at the Ice Center Promenade. For those of you unfamiliar with the Ice Center Promenade, it's the location of the last rookie showcase that saw Mikko Rantanen tweak his ankle just days before the Avs training camp in 2016. It's also the place where I took a puck off the top of my head watching that game. It's the home of beer leagues from ankle benders to college alumni to semi-pro to has-beens to people who still think they're going to make the NHL roster one day. It's not uncommon for people to spend a couple hours at Benders before the game and then go play the game and then come back up to finish off with a few more hours of drinking. This, my friends, is what beer league is all about. It was deja brew all over again, pun intended. But I digress. The serendipity comes in the happy accident of finding out that Jim Armstrong and Adrian Dater not only were buddies, but had worked together for decades at the Denver Post, writing for their various sports beats. Here I was with two microphones in a quiet room with two guys who represent probably 60 years of beat reporting. Imagine the stories these guys could tell. Imagine what it's like to be one of these guys, traveling the world, often with the team on the same bus or the same plane, gathering all the questions that they don't want to answer, asking those questions, and doing your best to hit a deadline and get it back to the paper, back when the paper was a thing, in time to hit the presses. So while we were staged to talk hockey, you don't let an opportunity like this pass you up. I handed off the microphones to Jim and to Adrian, and this is what came of it.
Can we talk about our old Post days and all?
Oh, yeah. I got more stories.
I want to hear your stories as much as anybody.
Our Denver Post stories? You want my single greatest Denver Post story? So, and I don't know if I should say this. Oh, he won't care. Woody and I, Woody Page, we've been on the road together forever, like Crosby and Hope. We're at Wrigley Field. This is... first year of the Rockies was 93, so it would have been 93 or 94. Good long while ago, right? And Woody had never had Gino's East Pizza at Michigan and Superior. Of course, I'm from Janesville, Wisconsin, which is right over the state line, 100 miles from downtown Chicago, whatever. So I'd been to Gino's Pizza. It's cult pizza. Bruce Springsteen and Mick Jagger and all these personalities go down and all these actors, and they scratch their names on the wall. But it's literally... the deep dish pizza in Chicago. Like, Woody, we got to get a Gino's pizza. So it's like all day long, it's like, all right, it's one of those day games at Wrigley Field. Let's write all our stuff and get some Gino's. Okay, that's our game plan, right? Boy, about the fifth or sixth inning, Woody looks at me and says, I don't know, man. I just don't feel very good. I don't know what's going on here. And then every 15 minutes, be like, geez, what's the deal? I'm just not feeling good at all. So... Woody ends up at the end of the game. He says, hey, I'm going to go down to Northwestern Hospital, which is 10 minutes from Wrigley Field. I'm going to go down to the emergency room I'm not feeling good. So anyhow, I go to Gino's and get the pizza. And I meet Woody at the emergency room in the Northwestern University. And he had a heart attack. So I walk in and Woody's standing there with his doctor. And the doctor's saying, we got to get you on this, you know, lean and mean diet, and you can't do that. Reading them the Riot Act, the Ten Commandments of getting healthy because you just had a heart attack. And I'm standing there. He says, you got to eat right. And I'm standing there. Woody, I got the deep dish pizza from Gino's. And this doctor looks at me like, who are you? Go away now. Yeah, just a little heart attack. Let's go eat some pizza. Okay.
God.
Yeah, no, we...
traveling with Woody. I'll never forget being on the road with Woody in New Jersey covering the Stanley Cup Finals 2001. I don't know if Woody wants to hear this either, but hell. wrote, you know, Woody, write this, sometimes he'd write this "Your City Sucks" column.
Oh, yeah.
And he basically brought out every New Jersey thing you could think of to say why they say sucked in Denver is going to reign supreme. And, you know, he had some pretty tough lines in there. One of them was about the Sopranos. And still, you know, the Avalanche are playing the Sopranos, and they're going to get shot, and they're going to get buried by them. And, boy, that did not go over well with Devils fans, who literally stormed around Woody during the game when the game started, because the press box was in the stands in those days, the old Brendan Byrne Arena, Meadowlands. And we were literally scared for Woody's safety, because there were guys that wanted to go at him, like these Jersey guys, and they all, you know, gold chains and thick necks and Italian suits on, and I thought I was going to get killed because I was sitting right near him too. And one of them didn't even know who he was at first, and he looked at me thinking, "Are you Woody Page?" I go, "Shit, no." And I said, "He's over." I didn't say he's over there, but and Woody, I believe Woody had to move at one point because the cops were like getting involved. So I think he stayed, probably. I can't remember that part actually, but I think there was a debate whether he should be moved out of the press box or not, because he may have. But you know, Woody didn't let it faze him though. You know, he's like, you know,
it was all a shtick.
Bring it on. Yeah, it was all a shtick. You know, Kisla does the same stuff sometimes still.
Remember the Jaguars and all that?
Yeah, the Jaguars. To this day, there are Bronco fans that think he cost them that game with that column. And maybe he did, right? Because they did get fired up, the Jaguars, on that column.
Maybe the single greatest individual performance I've ever seen by a quarterback at a game that I was at, right? Brunel threw 14 passes in that game that were a half an inch from the defensive back's fingertips. I swear. Pinpoint, all afternoon long. It's a miracle the Broncos were even in that game. Anybody else, and the Broncos were, as we saw the next 2 years, they dominated the league. In fact, you could still argue it's the greatest three-year run in the history of the league, right? But that afternoon, Brunel was just too good. I mean, so many edge pass rushers, Romanowski used to tell me, he said, "I was an inch from that guy a half a dozen times." And he not only got rid of the ball, but put it exactly where it needed to be. And as things turned out, you call it motivation or whatever, but the Broncos go on to dominate the league and win the next two Super Bowls.
So we worked at the Denver Post for a long time. Anything you miss about the actual craft of the job?
Well, let's think about this for a minute, Adrian. We worked on machines called terminals, on something called Deadline. Yeah, I don't miss it.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard. I'll tell you what, it is
writing,
a discipline.
You miss the craft.
The craft of writing?
Yeah.
I don't know that I ever enjoyed the craft of writing. No, you look at what we did. What we did, though, two-thirds of the time, if not more, you were on Deadline. Especially on baseball, like West, and the Rockies, of course, in the NL West with all those West Coast teams. You're just grinding and grinding, and there's always a deadline there.
And you covered the Rockies when they were just, every game was a fucking 14-inning or 18-12 game at Coors Field. You're never made.
Well, the Rockies would be up 12-10, and then Darren Holmes would come in,
yeah,
and I would sit there and go, "In the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy, please, one time, man, one time, get out of this game." So here's the other thing. I'll never forget those first 2 years. You remember the interest in the Rockies was off the charts. They broke every attendance
every
record. 80,000 people
every
their
game.
First game.
Every game.
It was insanity.
Every game.
And their bullpen couldn't get anybody out.
No.
Absolute insanity. But I would be sitting there, and I would have to write pregame sidebar, pregame notes, pregame this, pregame that, on and on and on and on. And then you'd have to write a running game story. This is all for the early editions.
Oh, yeah.
Me too. I'm cranking out so much copy, and I've got literature all over in front of me and the whole deal, and I'm trying to keep score. But I made the comment that first year of the Rockies, I was the only guy in Denver who didn't get to see the Rockies play.
Yeah, and I believe it.
I was sitting there just, looking up every now and then, wow, is this a game here? Who's playing?
Yeah. I believe it. I say that all the time to Avs fans. I never saw the final 5 minutes of a hockey game for a long time because I was always sitting there looking down at my damn computer trying to get that first edition runner out.
So it's an imperfect science, and it does pain me to see newspapers circling the drain. You know, it's interesting to me. I went to college 11 or 12 years ago,
yeah,
was it?
Wait, it's
decades
only been
11. ago. Yeah, I would have been a freshman in the hallowed halls of the University of Wisconsin. That would be 1975, thank you very much. Yes.
I was
my
10.
First game at Wrigley Field, that would be 1965. That was a few years ago.
The year I was born.
Yes, there you go.
I was born in 69. I was around.
Watching
I was
Dick
alive
Ellsworth
somewhere.
Bringing the pill
I
against
was breathing
Willie
air.
Mays.
I was born on January 6th, so chances are I was breathing air when you were there at that Wrigley Field game.
Yeah.
Did you suffer a letdown like I did after the Red Sox won the World Series? Like I can't really bitch anymore after the Cubs won it?
It's different now.
Yeah.
And I don't begrudge anybody, and I'm happy that the current generation of Cub fans, that they love the team and all that. I think that's really cool. So nothing bad to say, but it's not. Bleacher tickets were, and I hate that, go all curmudgeon on you, right?
Well, but you are a curmudgeon.
Let's
go ahead.
Facts
just
facts.
Talk. Just talk.
When I started going to Wrigley Field, bleacher tickets were 50 cents.
Same with me in Fenway Park. 50 cents.
Either that or we grab a grandstand seats in the upper grand for like a buck and a half, and the ushers would let us go down and sit in the box seat. There were 6,000 people there. Half of them were the nuns. Yep. There was a convent across the street from Wrigley Field still to this day. I don't know if you know that. I'd walk by and I'd say, "Sister, can you help out the Cubs pitching staff a little bit? Work with me." I'm not kidding you.
She's like, "I can't perform miracles, son."
I'm not kidding you. No, Friday was always ladies' day, and the nuns were in there. There was 1,000 nuns there every single Friday at Wrigley Field when I was a kid.
Red Sox.
It was really, you talk about a wholesome atmosphere. Now it's big money, this, big money, you know, the scoreboard from hell and all the yuppies and millennials. That's fine. I don't begrudge them, and it's fine.
The same thing happened in Fenway Park. You used to go to Fenway Park and buy a 50 cent or a dollar bleacher seat in the 70s all the time. And there were 10,000 people at Fenway Park. Even for some of their good teams, 75 Red Sox were a pretty damn good team. Went to the World Series. Jim Burton came in instead of Jim Willoughby and lost the World Series to
Joe Morgan. You still having a hard time with that, Adrian? Sounds like it.
I still am having a hard time with some of that stuff. Man, I was a serious kid who, you know. But, Fenway Park, now you can't get a seat for, you know, you're on a 10-year waiting list just to get into the goddamn park. I tried
one,
to buy
one of our hyper-regulars here at Bender's. I won't tell you his name, but he's a pretty, very successful business manager in the area. He's from Rhode Island, so he comes in and watches the Sox because we got the MLB extra innings package. He and I sit right over at the bar and watch the Red Sox. And to me, having another baseball junkie in here, most people here like hockey and football.
So you do get Nessun. You get Nessun in here?
Oh, yeah, we get all of it.
Man,
oh, yeah.
I'm going to be in then. I don't have Nessun, and I want Nessun.
But he is going back to Fenway in September to a family reunion, and he's taking all of his family members. He bought 14 tickets to a ball game September 9th. I'm like, how much did that cost? And he said, do not ask. He did tell me this. So face value when they first did the Green Monster seats, right, were $50. I'm like, okay, secondary market. He and his brother, they haven't been to a Red Sox game together in 15 years, so he bought two tickets above the Green Monster for $1,400.
Right. I was going to say.
I'm like.
I was going to go higher.
Holy.
I was going to go higher. No, I know. You can't get those seats unless you have serious bucks. Yeah.
Secondary market at Wrigley Field, box seats. Yeah, they're $600, $800.
Did you ever cover a game at Fenway? They didn't have any league play them,
a game. The Roman Coliseum back in the day.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, Jimmy was spared when the Gladiators, you know, somebody gave him a thumbs up and said he didn't get slaughtered by the Lions. Yeah,
I took the Christians and the points against the Lions.
You were didn't work Fenway. Out too you covered well. A game at Fenway.
I've covered many games for Fenway.
Oh, okay. I didn't know they had interleague play when you stopped coming, but they did.
I did World Series. I covered the Brewers back in the day up in Wisconsin.
You did cover the Brewers? Oh, I didn't know you even covered the Brewers.
The 1982 World Series
You covered
run?
The Brewers? I didn't know that.
Yeah, people forget.
1982 Brewers are a great team.
Raleigh Fingers got hurt.
Ted Simmons.
Vukovic got hurt.
Yep.
Or they would have won the World Series that year.
Yep. Ah, great team.
Gorman Thomas, Cecil Cooper, Robin Yount. Who's that? That big lefty who came out of nowhere, Mike Caldwell. Unbelievable. He used to be just a junk baller who turns into this 20-game winner. I remember being pissed off by that because I was such a big Sox fan. And great team. I'd love to hear some of those stories another time. Gorman Thomas, got to say one quick one on him then. I mean, he seemed like just the greatest beer-drinking ball player of all time, was he?
It was incredible. They brought in, and they had given up on Gorman Thomas. Had a really? Big swing, hit some home runs, but struck out, I mean, yeah. twice a game, three times. I mean, he's going to be a 210 hitter with 220 strikeouts, that kind of guy. Remember Rob Deer? Same deal.
Of course.
But in his younger days, and he did get a little overweight toward the end and all that, but in his younger days, Gorman could go get it.
Yeah.
But they brought in George Bamberger to be the manager. And his first thing, Harry Dalton was the GM, storied GM, good guy. And Bambi said, where's that center fielder? He could hit some home runs, but he could go get it. But he struck out a lot. You mean Gorman Thomas? Yeah, he's my center fielder. And Harry Dalton looks at him and says, really?
Yeah, because he has a
I think we have our first major disagreement here.
Yeah.
Anyhow, they put Gorman out there. Next thing you know, he won two American League home run titles.
Yeah, I did. I know. 45 home runs.
He's not a great center fielder by any stretch, but a good, solid, competent center fielder back in the day.
He could run. I think he had about 20 stolen bases.
Last day of the regular season in 1982, the loudest stadium I've ever been in. Brewers at Baltimore having to win. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. Robin Yount had two triples that day. When do you ever have anybody having two triples in the same game? Anyhow, they beat Jim Palmer on the last day of the season.
Yeah, I think I remember that vaguely.
And that was the unraveling of the Palmer-Earl Weaver kind of dynamic.
Yeah. Boy, got to interview Jim Palmer once for a story on unique pitching motions. He was great.
Oh, I've seen some stuff. Bo Jackson's last game? Oh, yeah. When he's just got a little thing with the hip going on there. I'm like, really? That looked kind of nasty.
Probably the worst. He was listed to the best player of all time that could have been.
Right? He was listed as questionable for the next week's game. Okay.
He was probably the best athlete
he was
of all time at that point.
And he could have still to this day, I would say Bo is the best athlete.
To this day, I think he would be the best athlete. He was phenomenal. But that damn hip, I know. I remember he was running down the field against Cincinnati Bengals, I believe.
Seeing what he did in baseball, even after the hip surgeries,
he's still hitting 25, 30.
Competent. You're like, if he had totally devoted himself to baseball instead of football, presumably he would have stayed healthy, wouldn't have that hip injury. I mean, Bo had Hall of Fame talent.
Remember he'd hit the ball and it'd be like, you didn't think he hit it that hard. And then the ball would be 50 rows back. You know, you didn't know. He just is so strong.
You didn't see that kind of athleticism on a baseball field.
You didn't. No.
So. Not like, I mean, you know, Deion Sanders, but I mean, Deion was a marginal baseball player. There were a few, but they were marginal in at least one of the two sports. But Bo wasn't a great major league player. But again, he had 30 home runs one year. And if he had stayed healthy and devoted his time to baseball, I have no doubt that's a guy who's going to hit 300-400 home runs, if not more,
easily,
and cover all the acreage you want out there in center field.
What was Fingers like?
Raleigh?
One-time Red Sox for 3 days.
Oh, he was – well, he had that magical year. Remember, he was the MVP and the Cy Young winner out of the bullpen.
He didn't throw hard.
So much movement. So much movement. Oh, yeah.
God. Always fascinated by him because he just didn't think. You think
that's what got him to the Hall of Fame that season.
Yeah,
but he tore a he had an issue, major issue in his forearm, like a week or two before the season ended, and was like, "Man, it's kind of bothering me." I'm like, "What's up?" You know, oh my god, anything happened to Raleigh Fingers? What's up, dude? You all right? And next thing you knew, he didn't throw a pitch in the postseason. And Pete Vukovic, the Cy Young winner he won 18 games that year.
Talk about a weird motion. Falling off the mound.
But, I mean, you know, a legitimate number one starter back then, and he tried to pitch through it, but he had what later was diagnosed as a torn rotator cuff. So you had your number one starter and your Cy Young winning MVP closer. Neither of them, one wasn't worth a darn, and the other one didn't throw a pitch in the postseason. And they still took it to, what, Game 7 of the World Series? I was on that team bus when they left. Man, those guys were crying like babies.
You must be a little like me. You were came in earlier, obviously, because you're older. A lot older.
More experienced.
But you must be a little like me when you say, at least we were in the newspaper business pretty much at the right time.
Well, now isn't the right time, I can tell you that.
No, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. If you started out today, you're not doing the stuff you did, you got to do back in the day. Not just because of the space and the no money and the papers, but the time with the players. You could actually talk to players back then. You know, you could hang out with players. All that stuff.
Yeah, it's very homogenized now. It's very staged.
Very staged. If you're a sports writer today, you are just, you know, a piece of cattle moving around, dictated by the PR staff, what you can and can't do.
But baseball is still by far the best access sports to the players. Yeah. And I'll tell you one of the reasons for that is a guy named Bud Selig. I mean, Bud Selig grew up in Milwaukee. I've known Bud for 40 years, give or take. Bud is very accessible. All the writers had his home phone number. Yeah. I mean, I know that he takes a lot of slings and arrows, and I know he was in the middle of it when the World Series. I get it, all the negative stuff, but that's fine.
I always
say what you will. I'm not saying he should be nominated for sainthood tomorrow, but you got to give Bud this. Bud loves writers. He appreciates the relationship between newspapers and Major League Baseball, which is now pretty much the internet. And Major League Baseball, because like you say, it's just newspapers are having a hard time with tightened deadlines. It's just hard to cover Major League Baseball in a quality way to the level it needs to be covered. But these internet writers, they're not on deadline.
Well,
they can write 10,000 words if they want.
Yeah.
Newspapers, you're very curtailed. There's very tight deadlines. There's very tight space.
No,
very tight word counts.
I work for a site now, BSN Denver, plug, that I can write as much as I want, and I don't have... Now, I think you have to be good enough for this, and I think I am good enough in one respect, that I know how to write my own copy, and I know what's going to be good, and you know, I know what should be in print and what shouldn't be, and I'm not going to mix... So, in other words, I don't have some... stupid editors dumbing my stuff down like I did a lot of times back in the days. I mean, I never forget being told by one Denver Post editor. I tried to be a guy who means references. I'm a pop culture kind of guy, I like music. So I throw in a song reference every now and then to my stories. So I put something in about the Avs were playing Detroit. And you know, the octopus thing, they throw the... So I think I said something about how the Avs were in the octopus's garden or something for one night. A Beatles reference.
That's almost funny.
Right?
Almost.
But I was told by an editor whose name we both know, but I won't mention, who said, I just don't think people get who the Beatles are, man. So I think we're going to
have
to... The Beatles.
Never heard of them.
Yeah, right. So we're going to have to cut that out. And I got so pissed.
They were a decent band, but they weren't as good as Kiss.
Oh, no. I mean,
I'm sitting at the same table with the biggest Kiss fan in the history of mankind.
I didn't mean to go there. I mean, the Beatles. I mean, if we're talking Kiss, then of course everybody knows. But
now, of course, that Adrian has a Kiss poster above his bed.
Well,
you did tell
almost literally
last month, was it?
Well, until... You're not far off from the truth. I hate to say it. You're not too far off. Although I do have a Beatles shirt on today. I forgot I even had that on.
I just got back from Maui.
Yeah.
I discovered that my
poor guy.
This guy's
got
a tough
life, doesn't he?
A million and one times.
My friend Jim
here
is really struggling, by the way, since he left the newspaper career. He owns a big ass hockey bar. Not just hockey, but all sports. And, he's buying another bar. You're opening another one on, Kentucky? And
I bet for 2 years.
2 years. I'm sorry. I'm a little
Kentucky
behind
the times. Newly
Inn.
Refurbed.
Kentucky Inn.
Friday Night Walleye Fish Fry. All right. Is that the last plug I could sneak in? Yeah.
Friday Night Walleye Fish Fry.
Well, again, I'm from Wisconsin.
I'm going to be there for that.
If you're from the Midwest,
well, I played a lot of,
is a cult fish.
I've covered a lot of hockey in Minnesota, dude. I know what walleye is for sure.
We get lots of Minnesota people in there.
That's what
Fridays.
They serve on the pregame meal at the Minnesota Wild games most of the time is fried walleye. You got to pay $10, but that's another thing that changed in the business. All media meals used to be free until, I believe, a hockey team was the first to start charging for meals. Florida Panthers, I believe. Well, my first 4 or 5 years in the league, you never paid for a media meal. That was always considered free stuff, right, Jim? You know, you got the free media meal and a nice buffet dinner. But they started charging. Now, I don't know of a single team in hockey that does not charge, you know, $10-$15 for the meal, which is still a pretty good deal, I guess, and you can write it off on your company card, but... Baseball is the sport to cover for food, too. I mean, the Rockies feed you like a king. They always have a hot dog stand open the whole game, I think. You can always get a hot dog, right? Free, always a big bag. It's like a big barrel full of M&Ms. You know, basically a barrel full of M&Ms. You can always fill a cup full of those.
Now, what our listeners don't know is that Adrian eats more than any human being I've ever seen.
Where did I do that with you? It must have been in
I've seen you eat,
press box like, a couple of times.
Yeah. Man, don't get your fingers near that guy.
Two supreme large pizzas for me in one sitting once. Hanover, New Hampshire, about 18 years old. 6'5", about 145 pounds. So I had a lot of room to grow.
Now you're 6'3", 270?
Now I'm 6'3", 310.
The wonders of age, ladies and gentlemen. The wonders of age. I used to be 6 foot, now I'm 5'11". I'm like, how'd that happen?
Really?
I'm looking up at my 22-year-old daughter. I'm like, yo, Wilt, how's the weather up there?
I've got a 14-year-old son who's 6 foot taller already. Life has changed a lot, man.
Well, we used to... It was so fun traveling on the road when we were younger and all that kind
of
stuff.
It was a great time on the road in the younger days, especially when you charge it to the company. I mean, there's a lot of funny stories about that. I mean, God, what used to piss me off so much about our travel at the Post was we had to have a receipt for anything over $10, right? The Rocky Mountain News guys didn't have to have a receipt for anything under $75.
And how'd that work out for him?
And how'd that work? You wonder how... there's a couple writers whose bar tabs that I won't mention. Probably now you know why Scripps Howard sold, probably. But yeah, they used to... You know, so we had a lot of $9.99 dinners, let's say, back in the day at the Post. And they had a lot of $74.99, you know, cab rides or something. But I remember getting... Rick Sadowski was a great, great guy. Covered the abs for all the years I covered the abs for the Post, and thankfully he's a great guy and we always got along. Competitors, yes, but many times Rick would just we'd have a cab to the airport and I'm like, Rick, I gotta get a receipt for everything, and he's like, don't worry about it, man, I got $75 to spend. So there's a lot of cab rides that the Rocky Mountaineers paid for me, basically. Probably some meals, too. Like, Rick, you put that on your tab, right? Yeah, I got it. $75. My limit's already reached here on my first beer. So my $10.
It was interesting to see how reporters reacted to the whole newspaper war back in the day in Denver. Some of them went nuts. Wouldn't talk to you, tell the other players, oh, this guy's an idiot, he's going to screw you. I'm like, dude, what are you talking about? Just go do your job.
I took it seriously. I was one of those guys who was obsessing about the circulation numbers all the time. Because I was a young kid, and I thought, I don't want this to end so quick. You know, when I first came to the Post in 91, guys from the Rocky would tell me, well, you know, you better get your resume polished up, because you probably guys are going to be out of business.
How'd that work out?
Well, I know, but it scared the shit out of me as a kid. You know, I'm like 26. I got my first big newspaper job. I love my life. And they're saying, well, you're probably not going to be doing this anymore in a couple of years.
Do you remember the blizzard of, what year would it have been? Well, I can tell you it was the Marlins against the Indians, whatever that World Series was. That was a few years ago. It was many years ago, 20 years ago, whatever it was. We had this blizzard in Denver. And I remember Gary Zimmerman had some big honking crazy like military vehicle. That's what he was. He was, and the Broncos were, they closed down the airport, and there's a point to this story. I'm going to get to it in a second, but it's funny. You talk about newspaper stories. The Broncos were the only flight they let out that weekend.
I mean,
there was
that.
4 feet of snow in Denver.
Right.
And Zimmerman had this honking, you know, like Hummer or I don't know what the heck it was. So he went driving all around town picking up his teammates and somehow got everybody to the cargo gate, and they got out of town.
I think that game was in Buffalo.
Well, but think about this. The reporters are flying commercial. Nobody could go to Buffalo to cover the game. Nobody.
Yeah.
Well, it just so happened Adam Schefter's from New York, and so he had gone out 2 or 3 days earlier to visit his parents in New York City. So it's Adam Schefter is the only writer in the press box from Denver. So I get a call. I'm in Florida covering the Marlins and the Indians, and the sports editor says, where are you? I said, well, I'm sitting in the press box here writing. It's what I do. He says, I don't care what you're doing. File your story. Call the travel agent right now. That was back when travel agents were part of the game.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, let's talk about another industry that's gone nowhere.
Yeah, our travel agent, Carol. Yeah, great lady.
Long story short, I booked a flight from Fort Lauderdale to Atlanta to Buffalo the next morning. I'm like, okay, the next morning. So I fly at like 6 in the morning or 5 in the morning, whatever it was, on Delta, which I never flew, so I'm like a fish out of water. I fly into Atlanta, and then I fly to Buffalo. And then I drive out to the stadium. I get there 5 minutes to kickoff. And Schefter sees me and comes running up to me like a new bride or something and jumps into my arms. He said, thank God you're here.
Schefter was a piece of work, huh? Guys, too bad that guy didn't ever
break it. The worst driver.
Is he?
Oh, whenever you got in the car, I got this, I'll drive. Once in a while, he'd drive. I mean, he's the little old man from Pasadena. You know, we're driving in.
Is he too slow or?
Just didn't quite. Oh, Adam, the car's coming at us 60 miles an hour. You know that, right? Oh, well, whatever. It's all good. No, it's not.
He was a piece of work. He, you know, too bad he hasn't had much of a career since he left the Post. You know, it's a shame.
There you go. Yeah. Then we had, where were we? We were in Buffalo. Has been an interesting spot. If you're a longtime Bronco fan, you know for about 10 years there, it seemed like they played at Buffalo like 7 years. It was crazy.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'm exaggerating a little. But, I mean, I was in Buffalo. It seemed like every single year. We go to the Anchor Bar, the home of quote-unquote Buffalo Wings. And I just felt like I knew the town like the back of my hand.
But great town. I like town.
We got in there one time, and Joe Sanchez, one of the other writers, he got into a squabble with somebody in the parking lot. I don't remember. And we got out, and they had slashed our tires. Oh, yeah. No, it's just, yeah.
Ask Kisla about the time I got into a parking lot squabble with a guy in Edmonton. Yeah, classic me. I lost my temper at the guy. He wouldn't let us park. I'm like, I'm a press person. I got a press pass. No, not official. No! So I lost my temper, and I was that trip was also famous for me buying shoes at the West Edmonton Mall with Kisla. I think Terry Fry was there. We're all walking around this gigantor mall, famous mall. And I needed some shoes, so I bought them. I was kind of in a hurry. We had to get back to the hotel or rink or whatever. Probably Kisla had to write a column or something. And so I bought these shoes too quick, and it turned out they're like a size too small for me. So I had to take them off in the press box. And my feet were just scrunched. And I turned in the night from hell because I was in my socks walking around the press box. Yeah, good old days, hey?
Adrian knows a lot about hockey, but common sense? Not so much.
There was the time I was in Florida covering the 96 finals with Kisla. Avalanche, Florida. We're at the swanky beach hotel. But we had all day to kill, basically. There was no morning skate, I don't think.
That was the cup season. The cup season.
We're there in the cup finals. I'm their rookie reporter and Kisla. So Kisla wanted to go walk around the beach, you know. And I'm like, that sounds great, Kisla, but I didn't pack any shorts. He looks at me like, you came all the way to South Florida and you didn't pack any shorts or bathing suit or anything. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't. So he goes to the hotel lobby shop there, buys me like this $55 pair of swim trunks so I could walk around these crazy gray, pink, you know, 80s style swimsuit trunks or something. And to this day, I still have those trunks. They don't fit me quite as well.
Do you know what's coming up in 30 in 5 weeks?
No.
August 8th. That would be the first ever night game at Wrigley Field.
No kidding.
And if we had a camera on right here, the reason I mention it is I was there.
Wow.
I was drinking beer and more
That's
beer.
That's a shocker.
And more beer. What happened was, I don't know if people remember this, but August 8th, it was 8-8-88.
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember if they planned it that way, but that was the first night game at Wrigley Field. But I went with a buddy of mine, Gil Whiteley, and the first game was rained out. I mean, it was a monsoon. So we sat there and we drank beer all night long. And the next day, yeah, great. We're just so hungover. And I'm going as a fan, right? But I've got the original right over here. I got all my Cub stuff. I've got the original program from that game and the original beer mug, which was in the shape of a light bulb.
Yes.
So somebody came in and I showed it to a baseball fan buddy of mine. He says, man, you know what they always say. Put this on Google or eBay. I'm like, dude, go away. No. I ain't doing that. But seeing Roberto Clemente play right field was something else.
Roberto Clemente? Yeah, I can only imagine.
The longest home run I have ever seen. Second. I'd have to give the longest Andres Galarraga's home run at the time. I think it was Joe Robbie Stadium, whatever they called it.
Yeah. Remember that.
I will never forget that. Talk about sucking the air out of the ballpark. Just the thud of that thing. He hit it.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Longest I ever saw was Dave Kingman right over the Green Monster by about 100 yards.
He could hit it a long
way. Dave
ways.
Kingman was when he got
Clemente hit it to right center. I was in the bleachers in right center, and I'm like, a right-handed hitter cannot hit the ball that. He hit it to the base of the scoreboard. I said, a right-handed hitter cannot do that. It's impossible. He was 170 pounds.
Yeah.
Clemente couldn't have been 180. He was 175. 5'11", 175, whatever he was. But to see that man play, wow.
Read that book on him by David Moranis?
I have read that.
You did?
I have.
I haven't read it yet.
I'll give it to you.
Do you? You have it here?
Yeah. I don't have it in my hip pocket or anything, but
yeah, okay.
And all we got in the back is whiskey and beer, but
yeah.
I can get it for you.
Okay.
I have not. I wrote a coffee table book on the Rockies' first season for Rich Clarkson. It was largely pictures, but it was a ton of copy. I had a lot of fun with that. I've written stories, longer stories that have ended up major excerpts in various books, but I've never written a book, and now I'm, 49, Adrian?
Yeah, I think you...
I think,
no,
again.
I was gonna, yeah, just coming up on 48, I think.
So I think I'm done typing. I can still type. People say, how fast can you type? As fast as I need to. Okay, when you're on deadline? Yeah. It reminds me of the day Broncos, it was one of the Super Bowl years. Elway was 30-ish, whatever he was. And there was a story about this quarterback who could run the 40 and whatever, 4.35 or whatever the heck it was. One of the writers said, John, what would you run the 40 and how fast can you run? He said, depends. Depends on what? Depends on who's chasing me.
Forgot how big that dude was.
I ended up on a, not that it was a great line or anything, but I wrote the notes column back in the Post, and a lot of it was pretty funny stuff back in the day.
Yeah.
I ended up on a Trivial Pursuit card.
You did?
It was, what NBA player did, Denver Post columnist Jim Armstrong say was one tattoo away from being all ink and bones? That's not a great line, whatever, but Allen Iverson, right?
Yeah, some good.
But the story is my niece calls me says, you're not going to believe this. I was sitting in my dorm room with some friends playing Trivia Pursuit. And the kind, this girl reads the thing. What, blah, 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 did columnist Jim Armstrong? And my niece said, oh, that's my uncle. And they're like, what do you mean? That's your uncle. Oh, that Jim Armstrong. They're like, you're lying. No. So she called me. So my sister went out and bought that game of Trivia Pursuit and gave the card to my mother. It was really cool.
That is cool. Man, that's a claim to fame right there. That'll never happen with me.
I don't think I have any other claims to fame, but I... No. We wrote John Elway's Hall of Fame acceptance speech. That's pretty good.
You did?
Well, you didn't know that? Yeah, and Shannon's too.
Huh, that's cool. Yeah. Wow. He actually wanted you, a real writer, to do it.
I guess.
Huh.
It was either that or hire some Hollywood joke writer or something. I don't know.
I wrote a letter for Pierre Lacroix to, on behalf of him, to go to the Hockey Hall of Fame, which I think is a complete injustice that he has not been there yet as a builder. This guy won 9 straight division titles. His first 9 years on the job as a GM in the NHL. Never been done before. Won 2 Stanley Cups with a team that had to move to a new city. Belongs in the Hall of Fame as a builder, I think. I think there's a lot of little subtle, I don't know if racism is the word, but bias against French Canadians a little bit when it comes to the good old boy network in hockey. Like, they're not part of
really?
The old boy network as much.
I would have thought that would have been a positive.
Especially in
since
management.
The early years of the league, that's all it was French Canadians.
Not when it comes
60s,
to...
70.
I think not when it comes to the Hall of Fame committees and stuff like that. They're all run. It's all run out of Toronto. Hmm. All the writers are pretty, just put it this way. I don't think... plus, Pierre wasn't the most buddy-buddy guy in the league.
Really?
With guys.
Shocking.
Yeah, I know. I know, right? I didn't realize I was being so ironic there. So, but he deserves it, and I wrote a big, long letter for him.
That is unbelievable that he's not in the Hall of Fame. Not many things shock me anymore. Like I said, I'm 49. Wait, I'm 48 now. That was right, 5 minutes ago. Yeah, really. Moving right along. Work with me. That shocks me, and not much shocks me.
No, I know. I'll probably write a lot bigger things. You know, sometimes writers can make a big difference getting guys in the Hall of Fame. Look what that guy, that no-name writer for, got Floyd Little in the Hall of Fame after all those years. It was basically his campaigning that did it.
There's no defined criteria for quote-unquote Hall of Famer. But I can tell you, I know one when I see one. And Pierre certainly belongs in there. There's no doubt about that. Wow.
First 9 years on the job, 9 straight division titles. Still a record. No team's ever won 9 straight.
Yeah, and it's another thing that we all knew that, just to drop a name, that Patrick Roy had to leave Montreal. It was a civil war up there. But I didn't see any other teams trading for him.
Nope.
It was like, well, what's going to happen here? Pierre's the one who got it done.
He barely gave up anything.
Rob Blake got it done. Nobody else traded for those guys.
Ray Bourque.
Yeah.
Theo Fleury.
Yeah. I mean,
big name. That was a big, big deal at the time. Pierre traded for Patrick Roy and gave up almost nothing. Basically set the Avs up for a 10-year run, you know, right there and there. He fleeced Claude Lemieux out of the Devils for a guy who wasn't even going to play for the team, Wendell Clark.
So. And we're sitting under Claude Lemieux's game-used jersey,
oh, yeah?
I think right there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Game-used, huh?
Yeah. Well, we got some stuff in here. We got a Rashan Salaam game-used during his Heisman year right over there.
Yeah.
We got all the original 6 in today's jerseys. Made by the company that makes the authentic NHL jerseys. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I love the original 6, just the logos.
Yeah. That was great. Yeah, I know it.
The Blackhawks and that beautiful color of blue and the Maple Leafs. Just a cool color of blue. And, of course, Canadians.
Of course.
We'll all be in the grave, and they'll still be the most storied franchise in the history of the league. The Bees. Adrian.
Covering games.
New England
Bees.
The Bees.
God, never got to cover a game at Boston Garden. Still a regret. First year in the league, covering the league. It was the first year they moved out of the Garden.
Got to cover a couple years of Montreal Forum, though. Wow. Talk about.
You want my Boston Garden story?
Oh, no, yeah.
I mean, if it hadn't been for the storied franchises that played there, most notably the Celtics, it was a dump.
Yeah, it really was.
They'd have
was.
Torn it down 20 years before really they was. Did. It was a dump. And I'll never forget being at a shoot-around. And in between, it was one of the Lakers-Celtics deals back in the day, 80s. And Bird was out there on the court, and a bunch of writers. Back then, it was pretty low. This was 30 years ago. Pretty low-key. There's a bunch of us writers standing there, and Bird's over there. And Bird's like, check this out. He would drop the ball down on the dead spots. He knew every dead spot on that court. He dropped the ball, and it would, like, stick like like glue. He said, that's home court, baby, home court. He knew every little nook and cranny of that place.
My idol.
But a buddy of mine, what the heck was this? Again, this was 30 years ago. Can't remember who it was. The game would end. You know, all the writers were writing on deadline, blah, blah, blah. But the security guys and the people didn't care. And if you didn't know the Boston Garden, it's a stop on the train, right?
Yeah,
right?
North Station.
It's just a stop on the subway.
There the other day.
That's all it is. All the subway stop. Oh, yeah, most storied basketball arena in the history of the world. It's like, what? Okay.
The subway station is literally inside the building in a way.
So at the game would end, and like an hour after the game, all the lights went out. Like, if you're a writer, you better get her done and get out of there. They didn't care. So this buddy of mine, he's writing, and it's pitch dark, and he's done writing. He's stumbling. I can't remember his name. Anyhow, he's stumbling out of there, and he's going down all these corridors. It's pitch black. He doesn't know where he's going. And all of a sudden, he goes, and there's like a dead end up here, and he hears all this like scurrying and all this kind of
rats,
stuff.
Right?
Hundreds and hundreds of rats.
Yeah. No, they're... They're famous.
And he hauls butt out of there, man. Oh, yeah. I'll never forget one of my early trips to the Astrodome back in the day. Talk about literally behind the scenes. The Astrodome at the time in the 60s was...
Space age.
Oh, yeah. No, it was like, wow, what world are we going into, right? We just, you know, and a year later, we landed on the moon, and it was like, okay, that was the late 60s. And... we go in there, and there's all the security guards. Of course, they all got their Stetsons on, right? Hey, buddy, what's going on, you know? How's the things up there in that Denver, you know? Cats everywhere.
Really?
Cats everywhere. This was under the grandstand, you know, behind the scenes, in the bowels, if you will, of the Astrodome. Cats everywhere. And these security guards would put out milk and food for them. Cats, and I'm like... What are you doing?
Funny. Feral cats,
said,
huh?
Buddy, you ever seen the size of a Texas rat?
Yeah.
He said, we got thousands of them down here. We take care of these kitties.
I'm like, whoa, okay.
Oh, yeah. No, it's gone. Is it still? Have they torn it down?
Yeah,
I think they did.
They tore it down.
Maybe. I don't really. Yeah, I've lost track.
I think
but
they did.
It's yesterday's news. I mean.
Yeah. But boy, that was a big. I mean, just watching games on
Sidney
TV.
Schlenker.
Just
old Nuggets awesome. Owner. He and Judge Hoffhines.
One of the most famous basketball games ever played was in that place. Elvin Hayes versus Lou Alcindor. Yeah.
Never forget that.
Yeah. Big, big, big deal. I wish I'd covered a game there. Tell you what, though. You'll never replace a hockey atmosphere like Saturday night in Montreal, especially when they played at the Forum. But even today, they have the best grilled hot dogs for the press between periods.
See, and, everything's defined by food with Adrian. You know, there you go. Yeah,
these are especially famous. And even players and GMs and stuff come down for those between periods. And that's where everybody socializes. After the first period in Montreal, is everybody goes for the hot dogs. And it's you're allowed one or two, but it's always the French Canadians. It's or deux. And it's, of course, it's deux.
Adrian says, I'll take two for me
I'll
and
take quatre.
Two for my buddy. You've never eaten a mere two hot dogs in one sitting in your life. You order them by the half a dozens. I've seen you in action.
Oh, man. I do love to eat. Pleasure. Especially, but I've never had any good Wisconsin brats, though.
Well, buddy.
I've never been there to cover a game. I was at the...
So on Sunday afternoons...
I did cover college hockey in Green Bay, though, once, believe it or not.
There you go. Sunday afternoons, we're a Steeler bar. We're in Nebraska... Colorado's for Nebraska on Saturdays, and the Pittsburgh Steelers, the local Pittsburgh Steelers, and they pack the place. I mean, there's 150 to 200 of them every. So I cook on the smoker, my grill out in the patio.
Oh, man, nice.
Beer boiled with spices and onions.
Oh, see, that's the key, right? The spices and the onions.
And I've got this little company that I do the oversized Johnsonville brats. They're huge. Oh, yeah. They're like probably, I don't know, maybe a third of a pound bigger than the ones you can get in the store.
Jeez.
Big honking ones. And I do it up. People are like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Cheese curds, absolutely.
Cheese
got
heads,
it all.
Cheese heads.
Everything that's fattening and bad for you, I got it. All right, I'll give you another Woody story.
Oh, man, I got some Woody.
And these, I mean,
we need to know.
And please forgive me if it's one of those you had to be there moments. So, Woody and I, this is 90, Rockies were 93, for so it would have been 92, the spring training of 92. And we're down just writing about just featurey stuff, you know, talking to established major leaguers. What do you think it's going to be like? And how do you think the breaking ball is going to be in the altitude? And is it going to be home run derby? Just basically setting the stage for Major League Baseball coming to Denver, right? And we're down there at the Cubs at Ho-Ho Cam in Mesa. And Mark Grace is in the cage. So I told Woody, I'm going to go over and talk to Grace and, you know, run all these questions by him. He's a good dude. And I talked to him a few times before. He didn't really know me or anything like that. So I'm standing there kind of waiting for him to get out of the cage. And he steps out of the cage, so I meander over. And the Chicago writers are standing 50 feet away with Woody. And they said, what the hell's Armstrong doing? And this is totally unbeknownst to me. And Woody's like, he's going to go talk to Grace about, you know, how he thinks the ball's going to fly in Denver or whatever. And, oh, you didn't hear the news? And Woody's like, no, what? Apparently, the Chicago Tribune that morning had written some big story saying Mark Grace is a drunk and his career's gone down the drain. So Grace, of course, didn't exactly need to hear from a member of the Fourth Estate. And I go toddling over like a blithering idiot. Hey, Mark, you got a minute? How do you think the ball's going to fly in Denver? And he looks at me like, go screw yourself. And I'm like, I thought it was a fairly innocuous question. You know, and he gave me, I talked to me for a minute or two. Okay, fine. I move over and Woody is laughing hysterically. Woody says, how'd that go? And I'm like, I don't know. It was kind of weird. He says, let me tell you why.
Oh, man.
Oh.
Jesus.
And Barry Bonds, of course, Barry Bonds stories. I mean, and one thing about me is,
I'd like to hear Barry Bonds stories.
Yeah, you know. I always had the comment, I'd ask the Pope about, you know, what boxers or briefs. You know, you got to understand, not all these guys love the media, but you got a job to do.
Yep.
So the San Francisco writers, I swear, would just cower in fear of Barry Bonds. I said, I ain't doing that. I go over and ask him a few questions. He'd look at me, and he actually gave me a few comments here and there, just basically to say, well, why would you add, and then he'd say, you know, go screw yourself. He was a terrible, terrible guy. But he came by it honestly because his dad was a terrible, terrible guy and had a terrible drinking problem. But neither here nor there. God rest his soul.
Yeah.
But
I found that too. Go up to the guy you think is the biggest jerk and just act like you're not, you don't interfere. Yeah, you're fearless, and you will often get somebody them to say that because they like that. They don't. Sports is all about intimidation and fear. That's all these guys do all day, especially in hockey. They're trying to intimidate, bully, get this guy around them scared. So it works the same with writers. But the way in hockey is you can't be bullied or else you're going to get bullied a lot more. You know, it's the same schoolyards thing.
Players deep down respect writers who stick their nose in and ask legitimate questions.
I never got any respect from Pierre Lacroix until I basically told him to go fuck himself.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the truth.
1980. So, what was Clemens' first mega year? 85?
86.
86. So it would have been the spring of 87. Remember when he held out in spring training? Remember that?
I think so.
Baseball players didn't hold out. That was Koufax and Drysdale in the 60s. No. Clemens wanted a crazy contract after his first big year in 86. Spring of 87, it's the Celtics and the Lakers in what now I would say was the most storied, to me, it was the most storied rivalry in the history of the league. Magic and Bird and all that back then. Unbelievable. Spring of 87, and I'm covering going, just exhausted flying from Boston to L.A. to Boston, back and forth. You know, it was just hard physically to do, and then having to grind out copy every day, right? I'll never forget, I'm sitting in the Harvard Marriott.
I've
not
been
that
in
I
that
was
hotel.
A Marriott whore in one of the points, but I...
Been in that hotel. I've been there.
I'm in the Harvard Marriott.
Right on the Charles River.
I'm typing away. And you probably don't remember this, Adrian Mayo. So Clemens had a very, very short spring training. He finally caved in, signs a deal. He's not happy. It's World War III between Clemens and the Red Sox. And Clemens starts out the season, and he's terrible.
Yeah.
He couldn't get anybody out for the... He missed spring training. He's just struggling. And the sports editor of the Post, Tom Patterson, God rest his soul, he says, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm sitting in a hotel room cranking out copy. That's what I do, right?" He says, "I want you to run over to Fenway and do me a big story about how much Clemens sucks." And I'm like, "What? I'm covering basketball here. What's going on?" He said, "There's no game tomorrow. Get over there." He did not. He was, that's what Tom, he, get over there and get it done. Click. So I have no notice. I go toddling on over, and this is back then, and the PR department wasn't exactly warm and fuzzy with the Red Sox.
Yeah.
And I told the guy, "Get over to Fenway." And I says, he says, "Well, what are you doing here? You're not a baseball writer. You're overdoing. But what's the deal?" "Oh, sports editor wants me to do something on Clemens." He said, "Today?" And I'm like, "That's why I'm here." "Yeah." He says, "He's pitching tomorrow. He doesn't talk the day before he pitches." And I'm like, "Oh, great. So he's already got the red ass because he can't get anybody out. And now there's no," he said, "buddy, you got no chance." And Clemens was really testy with the writers.
Yeah.
He was deep. And I got along great with Roger through the years. I interviewed him a million times. But that year, in that particular week, that particular month, ever since he came into spring training late and started out very poorly, he was like at war with the media, right? So I'm sitting there, and now the other writers, Gammons and all those guys, are laughing. I told them, "I got to get Clemens or I'm a dead man."
So what'd you get him?
They're all looking at me like, "Dude, you're on drugs. You got no chance in hell of getting Clemens." And I'm like, "What am I going to do?" So here's what I did. There's only one way out of this mess. It's 3 hours to game time. It's 2.5 hours to game time. It's 2 hours to game time. It's 1.5 hours to game time. It's 1 hour to game time. And back to the rule, I think it was 50 minutes before game time, the writers had to be out of the clubhouse. Mm. It's 1 hour and 3 minutes to game time. No Clemens. Well, he's pitching the next day, so he didn't need to come in 2 or 3 hours. So he came in 1 hour. He shows up like 58 minutes before the game. And I am sitting here. I remember just soaked in sweat, just stressed to the max, sitting there dying. There's no other way out. There's no conceivable way out of this mess. He goes, he sits down in his locker, and he looks like he just got out of Boston traffic, because he had, right?
Yeah.
He's sitting in front of his locker room, nobody else around, and I walk over, and I do the only thing I can do. "Roger, my name is Jim Armstrong. I'm with the Denver Post, and I'm probably screwed." And he starts laughing.
Really?
He said, "What's up, dude?" And I told him the deal. I said, "My sports editor's just busted my chops, man. I'm a dead man if you don't give me 5 minutes of your time." And he starts laughing, and he says, "Sit down."
Oh, that's awesome.
He gave me really good quotes for 5 minutes.
That's really good.
He said, "Dude, the clubhouse is..." I said, "Roger, thank you, thank you, thank you."
That's really cool.
He's just laughing.
Oh, man, that's cool. That way you played it smart. Sometimes you do have to do that.
Choice.
Just say, "Look,
there's nothing you can do.
Between you and me, I know this sucks for you, but you're going to help a guy out here if you do this." And I will. You don't say it quite so much, but I'll be like, "I'll make it up to you. You have a bad game, bro. I'll write good things about you."
Yeah. Oh, there was give and take. Oh. There was give and take.
I'm trying to think of the hockey players that everybody would say, well, it's more like coaches and stuff. I wouldn't care about stuff. Scotty Bowman was supposedly never talk to you, you know, especially if you didn't know you were out of town.
But he loved kids, right?
But he ended up loving me the most. This day, I still call Scotty Bowman. Talk about amazing things that I never would have said in my life. Scotty Bowman often calls me on the phone to talk hockey. to get what I think about something. What do you think of this?
Yeah.
He calls me to talk hockey quite frequently. Every time I see the phone light up with Scotty Bowman, I've got like, what the fuck? This can't be real. But I went up to him as a kid saying, look, Scotty Bowman, I'm Adrian Dater of the Denver Post. I cover the Avalanche. And, you know, I want to ask you about Steve Yzerman and the, you know, the feud you have going on with him. I think it was just because I didn't, you know, I somehow had this lack of fear.
Well, they got to know you guys because of the Red Wing rivalry for a decade.
And then he actually tried to, he had his little ways too. I think, he doesn't do this. But when he was a coach, he would try to pry information out of me about the Avs. What do you hear about Forsberg?
That was the greatest theater maybe in the history of Denver sports.
He would try to
get Avs Red Wings rivalry. Yeah, and a lot of, let's not kid ourselves. There's a lot of people. Oh, hockey. I'm a sports fan, but hockey. Yeah, I don't know. But I'm telling you what, that was great theater.
Some might call it a blood feud. I don't know.
Something like that. They should write a book and call it
somebody
that.
Somebody might should do a book. Yeah. It's still, it's hard, though.
His friggin' hand.
It's a
oh, yeah, no. Oh, there are quotes you remember.
Yep. I can't believe I shook his freaking hand. One of the funniest was Bob Hartley when he was the coach of the team. And long story short, there was a virus called the Love Virus that was attacking all computers back then. And, I don't think I remember the punchline, so but it was basically like, I click on my computer today, and it was a love message from Scotty Bowman. You know, he just...
Hartley was the best. You could always see him on the bench mouthing, fuck me.
Oh, yeah, I know. He said that all the time. Bob Hartley was unbelievably original, dude. Most hyperactive guy.
Working at the car wash, right?
The windshield factory. Most hyperactive guy I've ever met in hockey. Never stopped for anything. He just was always his energy. Just never stopped. Never stopped. And he never talked about anything but hockey. Just all hockey. All hockey all the time. He was so good about one-liners, though. He knew, because he worked in radio a little bit, so he's a media person. He knew what we needed sometimes. He would deliver a great one-liner sometimes, man. He said stuff like, we should have just put our goalie up against the wall and put shotguns on him all night long. It's the same thing. We didn't give him any support at all.
I feel like they're really trying to squash personalities in sports these days.
And now they kind of do squash it, yeah. Yeah, I still have the same PR staff.
Yeah, press conferences are a terrible thing if you're a writer.
I was on one recently where Dater was trying to talk to Joe Sakic about the recent signings, and it was a shit show. The tech, the people, the questions, the quality of everything. I could have guessed everything that everyone was going to say on this call, including Sakic.
Now, keep in mind, if you're a writer, you don't want things in front of a camera. And everything's in front of a camera now. That's what I say. Baseball, say what you will about baseball, but they offer the greatest access to writers. And you can get something because you get a guy off to the side one-on-one for a couple minutes, and it's a long season, and you get a lot of...
But now you got these team
tasty
PRs,
little tidbits over the course of the season.
Team PR staff people, though, who trail the writers around and take down everything you're saying. And a lot of times you got to say, get the fuck out of here. I've got a one-on-one interview here. Because what they do is they take whatever your interview is and transcribe it, put it on this team website that any fan, Tom, Dick, and Harry, can go read and steal. And bloggers can steal. And they do it all the time.
I asked you once, what can a reporter do in person that can't be done online these days? Because it seems like all the teams are doing their own press.
They are. They're in-house press. And a lot of writers are going to work for teams.
It's another thing that's hurt newspapers.
Yeah.
In the internet, obviously. I'll never forget, I was a sophomore at the University of Wisconsin just getting into the journalism school, and they had this guy named Marshall McLuhan, who was this academic at the University of Toronto, and his deal was Global Village. There will come the day, his PhD thesis was, there will come the day where technology makes the world a global village. And what the technology was called the internet. Well, I look back and I said, we should have figured out back then, what happens to newspaper then if everything's all spontaneous? News cycle is not going to work. And that's exactly what's happened. I honestly never look at a newspaper anymore. It does just, and I'm 60. So these kids today in their 20s and that, they certainly aren't going to look at a newspaper ever.
I sometimes buy the New York Times to sit and read it, especially the Sunday one. But, yeah, I don't read the Denver Post print edition anymore. First of all, I can fold the whole thing up, put it in the back of my little tiny pocket, my little slip pocket here I've got in my front pants, and still have plenty of room. I mean, there's just nothing to it anymore. Remember how thick? I remember the Denver Post when I first started working at the Post in 91. I remember going to the store, and I was all about the Denver Post. Like, it was a war to me. Like, I would get so upset when I saw the Rocky Mountain News sold out in the supermarket at King Supers that I would often, I did this dozens and dozens of times, where I buy all the rest of the Denver Post at the King Supers, because it was a quarter back then for the paper, and I'd usually have a couple bucks on me somehow. So I did that many times. I'd buy 10, 12 copies of the Denver Post. I'd go up to the checkout lady and go, she'd go, "Something big in the paper today?"
it's a Tuesday in August, dude. Said, what's going on? Jesus, yeah, did I miss the memo?
Got an article about me in here. So I want as many copies to send home as I can. But what I was saying was, back in those days, I remember the Denver Post Sunday classifieds section. In those days was 160 pages. 160 pages of classifieds on the Sunday Denver Post in the early 90s. They had to cap that page limit then. They could have printed another 100 more. Today's Denver Post, the total page count on a Sunday paper for the entire paper, probably 60 pages, 70. 160 pages full of one-inch classifieds that were all $50 a pop. You add that up, the revenue. All gone. All the internet, Craigslist took it all away.
Internet's hurting TV, much less.
Took it all away.
Newspapers. But it was just so fun, though, back in the day, especially if you're a newspaper man, because you weren't in front of a camera, and you could, they didn't have to have their on-camera presence.
Yeah.
You could get to know these guys better. I remember back in the day when I first got to Denver in 84, they had an AFC West in the off-season. They would meet in Denver, or usually it would be in California. But the coaches, I don't even remember, maybe even some players too. But we'd all meet, all the teams in the AFC West, we'd all fly out there and just have a little day to hang out together and do some interviews and get to know each other better. You just don't ever see anything like that anymore. You know, Marty Schottenheimer, I mean, I got to know Marty as well as any out-of-town writer in the whole league, I'll bet you. I'll never forget when Marty, and you may know this story, Adrian, this is Bronco legend, okay? Bronco legend. I'm sitting in the press facility at Dove Valley, and a friend of ours, I won't mention his name, he got divorced. He was getting divorced. And he was filing bankruptcy. And he called me, and I said, I knew he was doing bad. I said, "Hey, man, how's it going?" He said, "Well," he says, I got to declare bankruptcy, but he says, "You got to hire a lawyer and do all this stuff. So can you lend me some money so I can declare bankruptcy?" And I thought, so what had happened, unbeknownst to me, was they were just starting a conference call with Marty Schottenheimer. "Hey, Marty, you know, Denver Writers, blah, 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 and then, you know, two or three." Well, I was talking, I didn't notice that the conference call had started.
Oh, right.
And I'm sitting over here, and it's 12 feet away, and I've just taught my buddy telling me, "Hey, man, my world's coming to an end, and can you lend me some money so I can declare bankruptcy?" And I just started laughing, and I said, "Now, that's a sad frickin' statement." And Marty Schottenheimer had just been asked about all the injuries. And Marty says, "Well, you know, this guy's got a broken leg, and this guy," and all of a sudden he hears, "That's a sad frickin' statement." And there's this long pause. Jim Sakamoto, every time I talk to him, the Broncos PR guy, to this day, he says to me, "That's a sad frickin' statement." And I use that F word liberally, shall we say. But there's this long pause, and Marty says, "You talking to me?" It's Sakamoto's in the Bronco PR guys. No, coach. Nah, it's all good, coach. It's just a big misunderstanding. He's running around. He doesn't know what to do. And I look up, and I didn't even know what the heck was going on. Now I'm like, oh, my God, I'm busted here. So now every single time I'd see Marty after that, I'd walk up to him, and he said, you're a sad freaking statement. You know that?
I went up to Patrick Waugh one time and doing a story about how he's, you know, Jacques Plante was the first guy goalie to wear a mask. And talking about Patrick's mask, and I'm, I think Patrick semi-idolized Jacques Plante. And so I went out there, it was 95, I think, the first year. And so when's the last time you talked to Jacques? And I know you heard you know him and stuff. Can I call him maybe? Jacques Plante died 5 years ago. I go, oh wait, I knew that. I'm just testing you. I think I saved myself a little bit. But to this day, I still have Johnny Martineau, the Avs PR guy, the legendary PR guy from day one. Still ask me out. Patrick never forgot it. Patrick, man, I had some run-ins with Patrick, but I still love being around the guy. I mean, he was.
These guys are and the superstars. I mean, I always love the marginal guys who are happy to be there.
Such good copy. Could blow your head out. You just bite your head off a lot, but I always loved it. I always thought, yeah, that's great. I just got my ass chewed up by Patrick Waugh. I thought it was kind of fun.
In the immediate, when the Broncos beat the Packers in the Super Bowl, right? A year or two before then, and two or three years after that, the Denver Post used to do a spring training tour of the Cheesehead League, they call
it. Stuff, right? Post used to have enough money and everything we did. Let's go tour every National League West team in their city and do several days of coffee on them.
Now it's before
the season starts. No, it's like...
That sounds like Associated Press territory to me.
We got to string that Rockies-Giants playoff game tonight.
I go every year to the Cheese League, the Cheesehead League or whatever they call it. And there were, at one point, maybe six or seven teams, the Bears and the Saints and the Chiefs and the Packers and the Vikings and maybe a couple others. But I'm up there, and this is the year after the Broncos beat the Packers in that Super Bowl. And I knew Favre because I had gone up there, like, say, 3 or 4 years. And I'm from Wisconsin. I used to cover the Packers up in Wisconsin. So the PR department and I are real tight. I probably got a little preferential treatment that other people didn't get. So I was the guy from Denver. So every year, and you remember, Brett, the guy from Denver. Oh, yeah. I remember that guy. He's a good guy. Okay, whatever. So anyhow... Favre is just the most down-to-earth Southern hick you want to ever meet in your life. And he'd sit there, and, you know, I'd wait for him after. At one point, I remember, I thought, well, he's just stiffed me. Practice has been over for an hour, and I'm like, oh, God, I'm going to sit here. And I'm sports editor is expecting some big spread on Favre, and I'm sitting there scratching myself. I'm going, oh, boy. But all of a sudden, boom, door opens, and out walks number four. I'm like, thank you, Lord. So he's like, he said, I'm starving, man. He said, walk with me. Okay, walk with me. And we walk out this door, and there's 2,000 kids. Brett. He'll sign my autograph. Brett says, like, can't do it right now, guys. I got this important man with me. And I'm like, who? Oh, me? No, I'll never forget it. I'll never forget asking Favre, you know, Brett, here you are, surefire Hall of Famer now, and You weren't worth a darn as a rookie with the Falcons. He'd look right at you and said, never forget this as long as I live. Drank too much beer, Bubba. He and Billy Joe Tolliver, or as the players call him, Billy Joe Gunrack, just two hayseed, redneck, crazy Southern kids terrorizing Atlanta.
Favre seemed like a hell of a...
Anyway, I walk out in the parking lot, and these kids are everywhere. And Favre had just, like, the day before gotten... Remember when... Hummers were a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And Favre had some dealer or whatever gave him or leased him for free or whatever. He got a Hummer. And he's like, you ever seen one of these damn things? I'm like, no, dude. That's a little above my pay grade. you know. So he said, well, anyhow, he hops up in this thing, and it's about 12 feet up, and he finally gets in this thing, and he says, help me out, Bubba. He says, how do you turn this damn thing on? I'm sitting there trying to figure, and it looks like an airplane cockpit, right? And I'd never seen one of those things. I mean, and so the both of us are pressing every button on the dashboard trying to get the damn thing started. It was hysterical. Oh, yeah. Crazy. Just crazy.
I see that a lot. It seems like the guy wasn't ready to be done. I mean, I think I see that a lot, or I hear it from you guys, but I always wonder what it's like for a guy who's done with his career and what he's going to do next.
Well, it's separation. It's the ultimate in separation anxiety. Man. Players can't let it go. I mean, think about it. It's the only game. They literally boot you out the door. They tear their uniform off.
It's hard. I don't know. So many players have just had a rough time, you know, after they quit. Most of them end up divorced. A lot of them end up broke.
Yeah, I know players who sold their Super Bowl rings. I know a lot of stuff that I didn't necessarily put in the newspaper because I knew those guys. And yeah. A lot of them were having tough times. One of them was, remember, a big name Bronco player from back in the day was homeless for years. You see it all. But like, it's a little different being a writer. You know, when you're a TV guy or whatever, you got to be right there with the guy. And he's got his on-air persona for life.
Talk about what's changed in the business too, though. Remember when local TV news sports anchors had real power and clout in a town, and what they did mattered a lot, and they could break news. Has there been a local TV guy that you've ever even noticed in the last 20 years in this town? I mean,
no, but I'll give Channel 9 credit for hiring Mike Kliss. He gets a lot of scoops.
Yeah, well, I'm not talking. Yeah, I'm talking about the anchor.
The anchor, no, they don't.
They don't get any time.
Most of them don't even leave the studio, do they?
No,
they got about a minute and 45 seconds to. Sit
it's
there
ridiculous.
And say, da, 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 and that's it.
Where I grew up in Boston, the area, sports got 10 to 15 minutes in the 6 o'clock news. And they did in-depth stories where, you know, 4 or 5 minute stories. And I thought that was just normal. Today, it's just amazing. I mean, Ron Zappolo used to have some real juice in this town, you know. I mean, Ron Zappolo was a big deal. Now your TV guy goes to the press box and you're like, who's this guy? You know, I mean, but it's not their fault. It's just the business. God, TV is really different, local TV.
Internet rules,
really
man.
Don't know why they even bother.
Were you guys ever on TV?
Well, I've done been on
a million
TV, a million
TV
times.
Spots. I've done around the
He's
horn
been on
a million
horn.
Times. And
well, so the thing is, on TV, you never get time to talk about anything in depth, ever.
No, you go, you do your guest spot. I've done the Sunday night shows many times with Channel 9 and I think Channel 4, even Channel 7, I don't know. You answer, you got, it goes by in two, 3 minutes, you're done. You drive all the way downtown for that. And
I think that the long form is something that people have missed for a long time, and it's starting to come back with things like podcasts.
And yet there's still a lot of great TV stations that can do stuff. You know, there's channels and networks that can, I mean, there's so much TV.
That's why I appreciate Outside the Lines. I mean, that they still have a vehicle like that, a platform like that to try to do some in-depth stuff and bring in a lot of different opinions and really focus in on interesting topical kind of subjects.
I like HBO Real Sports.
They do a good job.
HBO Real Sports, I always like them.
Let's go drink a beer, boys.
As I said in the beginning of this podcast, I didn't walk into this thinking this is what we would do, but this is exactly what I am happy to find in the world of sports. This is the ecosystem that exists around all the heroes, the players, the people that you see every day. These are the people who bring it to you, and this is fascinating to me to hear these guys talk about the old days, the stories that they had together, and the life that they lived, and how they've transitioned into this new era of being a beat reporter. This is good stuff. A huge thanks to Jim for letting us do the podcast at his bar, Bender's Bar and Grill, just above the green rink at the Ice Center Promenade. It's an amazing bar. I've spent many, many hours there, usually right up until midnight or after midnight, depending on what game slot we got as I was playing my beer league hockey. But it's never been as good as it is right now. The previous owners were good, but Jim is amazing. The place is clean, the food is good, and the beer is plentiful. This is a place that you should absolutely be checking out. Go check out Bender's at the Ice Center Promenade. This show and every other show that we do is brought to you by AbsFam, absfam.com. Awesome hockey shirts and stickers and a lot of other stuff for awesome hockey people. If you like this podcast, tell your friends about it and then go over to coloradohockey.com and click on the button that says get it on iTunes or go to Overcast FM. Anywhere you can catch a podcast, you can catch Colorado Hockey. We love you people. Stay awesome.